Aaron Christie, David, thanks for joining me on Geared for Growth.
Thanks, Mike. Thanks for having me.
It's long overdue. You were kind enough to have me on your podcast. Well, you know, it was last year, and I've been really dragging my feet getting you. But we've got you here, we've got you now, and we've got you right at the time where your brand new book is coming out, The Happy Home Loan Handbook by Aaron Christie David. Get that in all good bookstores. I can see Booktopia, for example. But yeah, it'll be everywhere, right? Talk us through that one. It must be almost like giving birth, writing a book.
Look, I've had two kids, so I'm not sure which one's easier. I think writing the book's easier than two kids. But a bit of a labor of love. I was reflecting on it with a few friends the other day, and the idea's been in motion for years. And I think what's happened is our business is, 7.5 years. Over time, you're having so many conversations with people. So the book, I feel, is a collection of conversations that I've had that are a bit time-tested. So messages that have resonated with people, stuff that I've got, you know, really good positive feedback on as well. And so it kind of aggregates some of the ideas and the policy, you know, the philosophies that I have from how I've seen people that have gone on to successfully buy their own home. And it starts with that simple journey, buying their first place, and then it kind of takes them on that journey afterwards.
Beautiful. Now, I suppose the focus of Geared for Growth is more on the property investment side of things. Now, a big part of your book, I presume, will be dedicated to, you know, getting that first property and saving the deposit. But I'm really interested in what you kind of see from that moment onward, where people are getting stuck, where people are trying to build these reasonable size portfolios, but really it always seems to come down to a game of finance. Yeah. Now, I want to start off with a question that I'm surprised still kind of exists in people's minds, but why don't we just go with the cheapest rate?
It's what we've been conditioned by, and successfully by banks, right? To go shop for the lowest interest rate. And I can tell you right now, when you get the loan with the lowest interest rate, you're missing out borrowing capacity, sometimes to the tune of maybe 70 to 80, maybe sometimes $100,000. Okay. So you might get the lowest rate, but you've been able to buy less property or less home for that. And when I explain that to people, going, potentially that means you can go from a 2-bedder to a 3-bedder, or it's a 4-bedder, 2-bath on a 4-bedroom, 1-bath, or it's not buying on a main street. So the loan is simply the vehicle to buy more home. If we can understand that, and you might pay a trade-off in the slight difference in the interest rate. But really, when we're talking rates, we're talking very marginal, like what the banks would call basis points, so 0.1, 0.2%. In the grand scheme of things, I could generally look through someone's budget and find that somewhere else, whether that means one less meal out, or, you know, asking your telco for a discount, or asking your private health for a discount. We can find that somewhere else. But what you don't want to do is you don't want to compromise on the asset and the home that you're buying, and which is where that trade-off usually happens from a rate perspective.
Yeah, I mean, that's a big one that I hadn't quite thought of when I threw that question at you. I mean, in my head as an investor, it's always like, okay, well, there'll be a point where the bank doesn't want to give me any more money, so it's about growing. But you sort of raised the point about the quality of the asset, which may actually have even more of an influence on what you can do with your portfolio than the banks. For example, if you're getting it wrong, or you're buying at too low a price point for a particular area, because the gains aren't uniform, right? An area, you know, you could look at CoreLogic and it says this area went up 12%, but, you know, maybe the 2-bedders didn't grow at all, and maybe the 3-bedders, you know, grew at 15%, or, you know, there's a bit more of a nuance to it, right?
Spot on. And it's hard for me to explain, because I think brokers are so technical in some regards, and they've been doing it for so long, that to explain that in a client-friendly or a layperson's type of language, it gets lost in translation. They feel like we're just trying to sell them more debt. No, what we're trying to do is help you buy better. And so to your point, where you talk about within that suburb, sometimes I have clients that buy on a busy street, whereas if their budget could have allowed them to maybe buy a few streets back and buy something a bit quieter, that has much more appreciation than buying on the main strip. Now, you may be in that particular suburb and that got you in there, but if you just were able to kind of work in with your broker and go, okay, can we stretch a little bit more to maybe comfortably buy something that might be a better, superior asset? Yeah, the suburbs, we know it's not a level playing field from just being a suburb or buying a 3-bedder. It's, hey, look, I can buy the 3 or 4-bedder. Or the other one that's really popular at the moment is buying something that's completely renovated or at a high spec, rather than buying something you need to spend a lot more money or effort to renovate it, because when their building costs are through the roof, and then you need to come back and borrow more money. So you're borrowing more money later, or you're going to borrow more money up front to buy a better, superior asset. That's pretty much turnkey as well.
Mm, yeah. There's a lot to it, and people should go and buy that book because you've put a lot of effort into explaining it to the layperson. But for the property investor, let's say we're a property investor that maybe has one or two properties and we haven't yet hit the wall, but it's only a matter of time, would you say, that if someone's wanting to get to that, you know, to that rarefied air where it's something like half of 1% of people have six or more properties, what do you think they need to have in their head before they get to that point where a bank says, oh, actually, you know, it doesn't matter how much equity you've got, your serviceability doesn't stack?
Yeah, you're right. The serviceability component is when you go bank selection. And then it's to be able to think, you know, two, three steps ahead when you're buying properties. And maybe it's having that conversation with your broker to go, I've really got aspirations to buy and build a portfolio. I think some people maybe hold that information back and they're just going to buy the next one. And then we'll cross that bridge when we get to it afterwards. Mm. The best conversations that I have is when people go, I want to get to a 10 property portfolio. I'm like, awesome. I know what I need to do, which means we may go for smaller deposits. It kind of increases our ability to then scale up. And I know we're going to hit a wall here. So we need to think strategically, whether that's buying a property through a self-managed super fund or whether it's using trust structures at some point in the future as well. We can then kind of roll out the more sophisticated ways that investors are scaling up. And when I say sophisticated, it just means a little bit more advanced. It's nothing that's left for the upper echelon. It's quite accessible to people, but you've just got to be willing to have those conversations. And I think the next part there, Mike, is we're talking about the exceptions to the rule, not the rule, right? So you've got to be able to do what the exceptional people are doing. And I've had one client where they've got to get independent legal advice. They've got to go see a solicitor, for example, or a lawyer and get that type of advice. And they need documents signed because it's guarantors involved as well. And I was like, oh, that's a lot of work. I said, yeah, but you're doing what a lot of people aren't willing to do, which is why it's putting you in that 0.5 of a percent because where we've run their portfolio to. So it's a real mindset shift for a lot of people to go, if I want to chase my dreams of building a big portfolio, it's like us with business. Like you've got to really put yourself into that advanced category where you're thinking, this isn't a drain of seeing a solicitor or a lawyer. This is actually a really good thing that I'm now moving to an advanced category as well.
Mm. That's an interesting point. I want to go back to, say, the unsophisticated because I identify as quite unsophisticated in a lot of ways, probably no surprise to the listeners. And there'll be some listeners that perhaps don't feel like they've got any sort of sophistication around their mortgage strategy, and that's kind of what we're talking here. What people often talk about is like, oh, I've hit a wall, now I've got to go to a third tier. So I've bought this many properties, so I've got to get a loan from Pepper or Judo or I don't even know all of the names, but you know those kind of ones where it's like, I assume we're just talking super high interest rate and that's the only way to push through that barrier. Is that kind of an unsophisticated way of looking at it? Is there a bit more nuance to that? It's just not paying a higher rate and you get to keep playing?
Yeah, I think that's kind of the default mode, isn't it? Mm. Bank, major bank, second tier lender, and then you go into like the unknown world of like third tier lenders or banks that people have never heard of. And they start to get worried going, I've never heard of this bank. Are they secure? I'm like, well, every bank is secure. The risk is they're lending their money to you, right?
Yeah.
And then part of it is a pay to play. So they know as a non-bank lender, they're a bit more flexible in terms of their lending policies, in terms of their borrowing capacities. They know it. They know how they stack up against their competition. Mm. So there is a pay to play. You're paying for the privilege to have better borrowing capacity, to then increase your portfolio as well.
Mm.
But we know the growth on the upside, when you buy strategically, when you buy well, don't worry about the rate because the compounding effect on that interest on that property's value over time is going to surpass the rate. And at some point, people's incomes increase, rates will come down, that will increase people's borrowing capacities at some point in the future. Mm. So if you can kind of hold steady and use this bank as a vehicle to buy this asset, it's simply a means to an end. Yeah.
Yep.
So try and explain that as well. And I think that's part of it is part of a broker's role. But again, sometimes brokers can be a little bit, we can lack that emotional intelligence to go, it's the loan. What do you mean? You should just go and get it.
Yeah.
And people's fear just goes up going, this bank doesn't sound safe. Or they've got bad Google reviews. And quite frankly, find me a bank that has awesome Google reviews. They don't. But don't judge them on that. So you really need to have that really good relationship with your broker to go, if you think this is the right move for us, I'm going to have that trust and faith in you, just like you have your trust and faith in your buyer's agent to buy the right asset to deliver on your brief as a buyer. Same thing with your lending. So don't be afraid is kind of what I'd say. But yeah, your original question is that the mode or is that the only way forward? Sometimes it is. Sometimes it's getting valuations done with multiple banks. And I think that's part where if we can go back to that original bank, do multiple valuations on those original properties and go, is there actually equity we can draw out? And can we be, like you said, a game of finance? Can we find ways to unlock borrowing capacity? And you will be surprised. People are carrying car leases, giant credit card limits that they're not using. There's hex balances that we can pay out that will then increase borrowing capacity to a good extent as well. Salary sacrificing, which we, you know, some banks have different policies on. Don't be afraid when your broker's making recommendations to drop a credit card. The amount of times that credit cards will just become a sticking point. I'm like, it's a damn credit card. Get rid of it because you can buy a better asset. I think we just need to shift our behaviors around that as well.
Mm. When it comes to some of these second tier lenders, it kind of conjures up, I don't know, for me, maybe I'm just a weird guy, but it's just sort of like I think of some Eastern European country where it's just kind of rubble and then there's this bank and behind the counter's this old Romanian woman smoking going, you want money? I get for you, you know? It's like there is no real risk in these lenders, right? They're not going to default on you. If anything, the risk is really on them. So, like, is there a valid sort of concern about some of these lenders? Because at the end of the day, they're fronting up the cash and then you're paying them over time. What happens to that bank has no real risk on the borrower. Is that fair to say?
It's fair to us because we've probably been doing it for enough time and we've been around long enough to go, yep, they're secured. They're actually backed. They've got what we call funding lines. They've got money that they're getting from the big four banks.
Yep.
So you'd be surprised actually where some of these non-bank lenders or these lesser known banks are actually getting their money from.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So if I'm to put my boots on as a potential borrower and my broker has recommended one of these non-known lenders, so if they've got the Australian Deposit Taking Institute guarantee, you can check them out, go to the government websites and have a look and see what they're actually covered for. So they've got to have some type of, I guess, liquidity requirements in order to lend. And I guess our banking, and so when people look at the American banking system and then they get their horror stories from there and then compare it to here, our banking system is incredibly well regulated. I mean, there's a reason why our banks are the most profitable banks in the world. They run a very tight ship and the non-bank lenders aren't immune to that. They're hyper, hyper profitable of a very small population. There's a good amount of governance that goes in there. All the loans are stress tested from a what they call a national consumer credit protection legislation. So no bank wants to kind of do the dodgy to get the loan. I think those days are well and truly gone. And the other part is, you know, I was kind of started in banking around the GFC. So this notion that when the times got tough, those non-bank lenders would jack up the rates and kind of leave you in like handcuffed to this loan because you couldn't refinance somewhere else. That's not the case. And if they, you know, if we do come into some type of financial headwinds, you've just got to call the bank and say, look, get that rate down. It's the best call that people don't make, which is calling the bank, calling the discharges line or the retention line going, I want my interest rate reduced, and your broker can do it. You can do it. There's nothing stopping you from asking your bank for a discount. And the worst thing they do is say no.
Yeah. And so let's say we've got a couple of investment properties. We hit a wall and we've got this second tier lender on an interest rate that's 1.5% higher than everything else. And it just keeps us up nights. We aren't stuck with that forever, because if we bought that quality asset, the value of that will get to a point where is there sort of a magic LVR where the loan-to-value ratio is such that a first-tier bank would take on that debt, you could actually refinance it over? How do people normally sort of extricate themselves from those higher interest rates?
Yeah, there's two parts. So one is you have the serviceability. So you've gone there for a particular reason. So you've had to go there for a particular reason. What was it? Was it the loan to value ratio. So you had a small deposit and that was the only lender that would take it.
Yep.
Or your borrowing capacity was scraping the barrel effectively. And this was the only couple of lenders we could go to. So the best of a bad bunch. Now what happens is over time, have you got a pay rise or have you got a bonus or have you got some extra income or has the rental income even increased across your portfolio that then allows us to go back through, rerun the numbers and work out who you qualify with. So that's a big one. There's other lenders that are doing like just purely on a refinance, loan, the loan serviceability is usually around that 3%. So when you apply for a loan, they usually do the assessment rate 3% above. If you're doing just a straight refinance, there's some banks that are applying like a 1% serviceability test. Right. So you might not be able to pull too much equity out, but to your point going, this rate is keeping me up at night and I don't want to go and pull more equity out, just straight refinance, then speak to your broker about one of the lenders that do the low servicing on the assessment rate, straight refinance as well.
Yep.
And that may give you a bit of sleep at night factor on the rate.
And are there better jobs for brokers than others? Let me explain exactly what I mean. Like, does someone like you pick up the phone from someone and they say, look, I need a mortgage for an investment property. Another conversation might be, I need to refinance because I've got a high interest rate and I want to go back to a major bank and reduce that. Is there an incentive for brokers to do one more than the other with more energy? I'm just wondering about kind of the incentives, right? Because we all kind of know that brokers get paid by the banks, but is all work equal? Like, should the consumer know that, look, unless you have a really good strategic mortgage broker, they're probably not going to be interested in doing this for you or creating strategy for you or anything like that. Is there something in that you feel the consumer needs to know?
Yeah, I think there's two parts to it, Mike. One is, I think, what a client thinks we get or a customer going, I think you're suggesting that lender because you get paid more by that particular bank. And after the Royal Commission, I'm really happy that it's kind of brought a lot of the lenders paying brokers parity on the commission. Mm-hmm. So that's one part. So I'm not skewed to go recommend Macquarie Bank over CBA or St. George, for example, because we get paid pretty much exactly the same. Mm-hmm. There might be small differences, but it's marginal really. And then the other part is, are some loans more equal than others, which is $1 million loan worth my time over, say, a $200K loan? Because I get paid more than $1 million. I can tell you right now, some of the loans that we do, the $200K loan is much work as a $2 million loan. So the work's the same. The loan process is the same regardless of how much the loan is. It's just the trade-off is slightly different. But let me tell you, the $200K loan client that goes and buys again and again and again and then refers and recommends us is actually, call for what it is actually an awesome client because they're coming back, they're growing their portfolio, they're recommending to family and friends. So that client's a superstar compared to the $1 million client who wants the lowest rate, no fees, for example, busting our chops. And there's no feedback loop on that and they're not recommending us either. So I look at it as a fit being an attitude. Are you looking to grow a portfolio? Are you organized as well? That's a big one for brokers. You know, there's no doubt we're paperwork monkeys at sometimes as well when we're asking for documents and some information. So have a client that's organized is a dream. A client that has a vision for where they're wanting to get to. So that allows a broker to kind of go from being a rate chaser to being an enabler. And that's really important that we can go, hey, look, we can come back in 6-12 months time going, we've revalued your property. There's equity and you've got borrowing capacity. Are we thinking about going again? That's where a broker can lead a client. Whereas if the conversation is just sticking around rate, I don't know. The industry talks about it. A client comes to you for rate, they'll leave you for a lower rate. And so not a lot of brokers want to play that game. And quite often, if you're leaving a bank, the discharges and retention team are extremely good at trying to keep a client on their books as well. So it can mean a lot of hard work for the 11th hour when the bank swoops in to kind of retain that loan to go, oh, there's no payoff here either. So I think there's, again, I know what I do because there's so much work that goes on behind the scenes for brokers. But where you really want that great relationship with your broker is to go, hey, look, how big can we think? Or is it, I just want to pay off these loans, I want to pay off these loans as quickly as possible, get that passive income, and then I want to be on my way. It's like, hey, awesome. But we know exactly there's a loan strategy here and we can execute to that brief as well.
Yeah, awesome. And I guess the word that you said was fit. So I feel like, especially for a property investor, a broker has to be someone that you want to do business with. I don't think that as investors we should consider it a one-way street. Us being organized is going to make you much more enthusiastic to work with us, right? Yeah. So it's a partnership, but you've got to be able to, you know, the relationship is important is what I'm getting at.
Absolutely. The amount of times that I haven't heard from my broker is one that comes up. I was like, hey, did you call them and just reach out to them as well? They're like, no. I'm like, this is it. It's a two-way street.
Yep. Yeah.
Reach out to your broker as well. Look, I'm guilty. We all get busy. There's only so many hours in a day, especially when you've got new people coming at you, you've got referral partnerships and you've got existing clients. So to do the dance and try and manage between them, and you've got to understand 60% of our industry are solo operators.
Yeah, right.
That's a lot of heavy lifting for single brokers to do on their own when they're trying to manage revenue generating work, revenue protection work with their own existing clients when everyone's nipping at their heels, and trying to build relationships with partners as well. It can be quite a lot for a solo broker. And my heart goes out to the brokers that are doing it on their own. I can't, which is why I've got an awesome team, which means we divide and conquer, which means you get good at some parts. So I can be really good at talking to a client, unpacking what they're looking to achieve. And I've got a team that can kind of look through the nuts and bolts and the numbers, work out borrowing capacity, no policy, because that's, that can often thwart a deal as well. And then someone that can take that loan through from lodgement all the way through to submission, then the team that manages loans ongoing, where we ask banks for regular discounts on our existing clients. Last week, our team alone saved $15,000 in 1 week of interest repayments, just on interest, by asking banks for discounts.
Wow.
That's $15,000 going back into our clients' back pockets immediately, not into a bank's bottom line. So again, finding the right fit, we'll come back to exactly what you just said there, it's a fit. So it's not the charisma side. It's going, hey, look, is this brokerage going to be able to enable me to grow and scale my portfolio, because they're growing and scaling as well?
Mm. I think you're a double threat, mate. I think you've got that and the charisma in spades. I want to ask you about, let's say, people that have a goal to be one of these people that are six or more properties, but they have a modest income. So let's say we're talking $80,000 to $100,000, which is probably on average for property investors. I haven't seen the latest ATO data on that, but certainly we were seeing that after tax it was under 80. So maybe 80 to 100 is that sweet spot. Do you feel someone coming to you saying, Aaron, I earn $80,000 to $90,000 a year. I want to grow a 6 investment property portfolio on top of my own home, which I have now at an 80% LVR. Is there a point where you kind of see, okay, well, I know you're going to get stopped by your salary rather than the property? Or is the salary something that is actually not that important when it comes to the overall health of the portfolio? It's more about a yield and a cash flow sort of thing. Like, how does your brain think about someone in that situation that says, Aaron, I've listened to the podcast and Mike was right, you were charismatic and knowledgeable, help me build this?
Yeah, there is no doubt we're going to hit a wall at some point on an income. But, and the big but here is, can we go into an aggressive growth phase for a few years? So we're buying aggressively for a couple of years and scaling up our portfolio. And then it's at a point where we've hit that wall. Okay, great. We may be sitting on the sidelines just for a little bit. But what I really want you to do in the meantime is I want to upskill your income. And most people don't realize that their personal income is the biggest adjustable that there is. So they're putting all their hopes and dreams into the property, which is cool. That's absolutely one way to make wealth. But the other way to make wealth is, how do we turn your 80K into 110, 120K? And when people start to connect the dots on that, I can hear it over the call. Like the lights are then going off and the bells are ringing inside their head going, yeah, I can feel even my career is just getting a little bit stagnant here. So how do we talent stack someone? So that, what that means is, how do you then get that next pay rise? How do you find that next career opportunity that's going to give you a higher income that's going to enable you to go and buy more properties? Yeah. So we can do some work on the properties. Maybe it's a small strategic reno, flooring, painting, bathroom, kitchen, for example, get the property revalued, pull the equity out, let's go again. Really, really smart, good return on time, time and investment as well. That's one part. Are we looking at properties that have cash flow upside by putting a granny flat on the back? Mm. Awesome. It's going to supercharge the cash flow side as well. Are we missing some tricks around depreciation? You see it time and time again. We're leaving money on the table here. Mm. So how do we avoid that trick? And then the next one is keeping expenses low. So things like car leases and going by an expensive car on payment terms is probably the number one killer to people's borrowing capacity. So you can your income's going up, but your money habits are keeping you poor and stopping you. So you're telling me one thing, but you're doing something else.
Yep.
You say you want to grow a portfolio, but you've got a giant credit card limit. You say you want to grow a portfolio, but you've gone and bought an expensive car on a loan. That $700 a month is absolutely murdering your borrowing capacity. And I can say this firsthand. Like I will put my money where my mouth is. So I had a nice car, Golf GTI at one point, nice. On lease, because that's what you do when you're self-employed. And when we did the numbers, I saw how much it was killing my borrowing capacity. I drove it into a dealership. I walked out with a 10, 15-year-old Mazda 3, and I walked out with a check. It's rare that people walk out of a dealership with checks.
Yeah, right? It's always upgrade. You know, right. Got to go forward, got to get better.
And the first thing that people would say is business not going well, that you have to trade in your car for a lower vehicle. I'm like, no, I want to keep buying property. I want to keep making money. The car is a depreciating liability. I want income-producing assets. Mm. So, again, if I feel like I'm skirting around the question, it's because I need to have people on this journey to go, there are ways to scalp your portfolio on an income surface 80 to 100K.
Yeah.
But how do we turn the 80, 100K into 110, 120? By focusing on your self-development, by leaving bad money habits at the door, by not engaging with credit cards, car loans, personal loans, for example, and we're putting all our eggs into the income-producing asset basket, that's going to give us the kick that we need.
Mm. Yeah, I suppose it's easy to kind of think, oh, gosh, you know, like I'm blocked, the banks won't lend me any more money, and you're on 80 grand and you've got your GTI and you've got your wine subscription and you're thinking, oh, you know, like I just have a little bit of Russian caviar every second weekend. This is not based on a true story. I've never had Russian caviar. I'm just trying to think of something expensive and ridiculous, right? But a lot of this stuff, at the end of the day, it's a game of multiples, right? We hear about that old story about, you know, you can buy six times your income and that sort of goes up or down, but
yeah,
it's the income and the expenditure, all that lifestyle package. And if you are serious about building a big portfolio and you aren't the CEO of a major business earning $500,000 a year, you can still do it. You just have to be much more strategic. Is that a fair way to put a bow around it?
Spot on. It blows me away that I have people that are in 80 to 100K roles, like maybe they're out of uni, for example, so they're late 20s, early 30s, for example, or they're in a white-collar role, maybe blue-collar at that point. But with their property portfolio, they're actually worth far more than their manager above or their manager above them as well.
Mm.
And it blows me because sometimes we do work inside an organization. And granted, I get to see everyone's portfolio finances. We're in an interesting position where we get to see everyone's under the hood of everyone's financials. And so sometimes the people that are on those higher incomes, their lifestyle creep is just through the roof.
Mm.
They've got kids in private school. They've got the beautiful cars. They've got the mortgage that's keeping them at the eyeballs, for example, the expensive holidays, the dinners out on the weekend. There's actually nothing left to show for it.
Mm.
So as their income has gone up, the expenses have kind of kept up as well, sometimes even more higher. It's cutting it so close to the bone, there's actually no savings left. Whereas I take someone on, and it's harsh to call it an average income, but it's a median income, circa 90K Australia. But I can take someone on 90K income and I can help them outperform their peers and the senior people in their organization through property. And we see it time and time again. Like I was listening to a few podcasts where, Australian Property Scout, their team and how they're growing internally, like their own team. I'm like, there's some young people there that are sitting on some incredible portfolios that are outperforming people that are degree qualified, double degree qualified, working in the city, that are spending $20 every day for lunch and, you know, got to dress in expensive clothes, for example. that are in extremely good finance jobs, but doesn't even know where their own finances are going. And that's kind of the irony you see for a lot of people, especially finance. They work in finance and they know their employer's P&L and their budget intimately, but they don't know their own P&L and their own budget intimately. And that's a great, that's a great shame. I feel like they're missing these awesome years of their life to put down roots and to make some good decisions that they're going to be the beneficiaries of in 10, 15 years' time. That's when the trade-off really comes in, when you've got the choice to work less, when you've got the choice to take that holiday without guilt, when you've got the choice to buy that nice car because your income-producing assets are now giving you that cash flow that you don't feel the guilt around that as well.
It's funny, isn't it? Like you probably observed this yourself. The people that are, you know, somewhat wealthy look wealthy. The people that are super wealthy, they look, they spend effort looking less wealthy. Like it's kind of funny. It's sort of like the grass is greener. You've got to, you know, what's the Amy Cuddy, fake it till you make it. You've got to have all the nice sort of stuff. But the people that have really cracked through it, they've found a way to go, you know what, it doesn't matter. And credit to you for getting a Mazda 3, which I've been in one. It's all right, but it's no... It's no GTI, right?
It is no GTI.
It's trust pretty ordinary.
But it's a phase in life, mate. I've got two small kids. They trash the car. And I'll be around, you know, clients or peers, and they've got small kids and they've got these beautiful, I don't know, BMWs or Porsches. I'm like, I don't know, mate. The kids are just going to trash this car for a while. It is a blow to the ego. There's no, I'm not going to sugarcoat it. It can feel like a blow to the ego, but that's where, to your point, when you've crossed over this like wealth mindset and you get to the point, I don't really care what people think of me because they don't know what I'm. And I think property can be a bit like that. It's a bit hidden. It's wealth unseen. And if you've read the book, The Psychology of Money, there is a difference between wealth and being wealthy and being rich.
Yep.
And I've never heard someone articulate that before. We kind of just associate that wealth and rich goes hand in hand together, but it's not. And I recommend if anyone wants to check out the book or just watch a YouTube video from Morgan about his philosophy around it, I feel like these are just those penny drop moments that when you're going on that journey to try and create true wealth, you'll see what the trappings are of being rich on paper or rich to people and trying to impress people, that you just go, I need to take the path less traveled as well.
Yeah. Do you want to look rich or be rich? And it's not even rich. It's do you want to look like you're financially on a good wicket, or do you want freedom tickets and the ability to choose what you want to do in life? And, you know, I've spoken to many super, super wealthy people, and honestly, if you saw them in the street, you'd offer them a sandwich, you know, because they just don't care. But yeah, check out that book, Psychology of Money. But while you're at the bookshop, make sure you pick up the Happy Home Loan Handbook by Aaron Christie David. That's my FM radio voice plugging your book. We should also plug your podcast as well. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Thank you, mate. Yeah, look, the Australian Property Investment Podcast, like a lot of things in life, like the book or the podcast, this is not about, it's not about me, and people might be thinking, how can you say that? You're the voice or the mind behind it. No. I've had that many conversations. I want to grow personally. I want to grow professionally. I want to grow my own property portfolio. So I've had to find the answers out myself. And it's given me an unfair advantage to get off incredible people. Yourself, for example, there's so many captains of the industry that have jumped on going, I actually want to help more people successfully buy and build a quality portfolio. So you've got so many people that want to give their knowledge and just make sure that property investors are making the right decisions. There's something admirable about that. And if I can be a conduit to those conversations, and I've had people, we had one client yesterday, hey, man, I've been listening to the podcast for 12 months and now I've reached out. I'm like, my heart sings. The work that has gone into that has made it worthwhile because someone's been on a 12-month journey and then decided to reach out. I'm like, thank you. Because it makes that work really kind of valuable and a payoff because you've been educating, upskilling yourself on that way. 12 months ago, you weren't ready. But what would that person have done for 12 months? They would have just been in the ether. And now they've had a pathway. They've picked up nuggets. They've picked up insights. They've connected with other professionals. It's really enjoyable. I get a real kick out of that.
Yeah, no, I love it. Me too as well. And I don't get lots of people reaching out, but the ones where they feel compelled to say, I learned something and I did this, and without that, I wouldn't have done it. And I'm so grateful I did. I guess that's what That's what we're all here for, mate. So,
exactly, isn't it? Yeah, it's nice to get awesome. a bit of feedback loop on what's going on and what's resonating as well, right? Mm. I mean, yeah, we're no diary for CEO, but this is it. Like, you look at the average number of podcasts out there. I think the average episode number is 7. So again, it's like you take everything, Mike, as the analogy of life. It's like property investors. There's things that the exceptional people are doing very well. The 1%ers. So the 1% of podcasts, like, look how many episodes of Property Trio is created, right? Look how many episodes you've done here for Gear for Growth. Look at how, look at the top 1% of businesses, you know, cracking 2 million in revenue. Like, they're doing something exceptionally well. One, they're surrounding themselves with like-minded people. There's a good mindset around growth as well. They're not willing to accept the status quo. And the same could be said for property investors. The 1%ers want growth. They're not going to take no for an answer. They're going to do what the uncommon are doing. They're going to find the right team of professionals. They're the hallmarks. So you can apply property investing to the analogy of life. I find the rewards for people that have done exceptionally well is because they've put themselves in the driver's seat.
Mm. Yeah, awesome. Wise words, mate. And to finish us off, thinking about the property investor, either aspirational or in the build process, what do you think are some of the most important things for them to understand from the mind of a strategic mortgage broker to ensure that they get to where they want to get to?
I'd say number one is have a heart-to-heart conversation. And what I mean by that is, hey, look, I've got ambitions to grow to here. Quite often you'll find that that mortgage broker, if they're gonna kind of reciprocate and effectively mirror you at that point, going, I think we can help you get there, or we're gonna be a conduit to help you get there. Some mortgage brokers may project their own insecurities. And I say it because I meet a lot of brokers and they're like, nah, can't do it. I'm like, who are you to say no? If the client wants to find a way, and I have lost clients at the very early stage in my journey, there were clients that were bigger than me. And they went somewhere else, and I'm glad they found a bigger and better mortgage broker. But that just made me hungrier. It made me hungrier to go. I need to upskill myself, sharpen my knowledge, sharpen my product knowledge as well, to then start to work with, you know, hungrier investors. So to someone listening that wants to find the right mortgage broker, be open about what your plans are. Show them exactly what's going on from a financial perspective. Tell them a little bit about where you think you're going to get to in the future. If you've had some setbacks, talk about that, whether it's bought the wrong property or you had issues with tenants, for example, or you have fears around rising interest rates or cash flow is going to get tight, or you're thinking about starting a family. Tell those really important parts, because we can then navigate that from a lending perspective. And the next part is then build that relationship where you're going, hey, we're checking in every 6 to 12 months, because now I'm holding you to account, which is, you said you want to buy 5 properties, 6 properties. Why are we not pulling the trigger on this? When you said you were going to. And sometimes I feel that we can think bigger and have a bigger vision for our clients than they have for themselves, because something happens here, Mike, right? They've got the ambitions to grow, but then dealing with property managers or a tenant that pays rent just dents their bit of confidence.
Mm.
And I've met with a positive psychologist, and they said, the ratio is 3 to 1. We have 3 times more negative thoughts than we have positive thoughts. And so it really can dampen your confidence to go, rising interest rates, tenants have, you know, damaged the property, you've got hot water to replace, but then that's 3 issues. But where's the one good thing?
Mm.
It's hard. It's hard to see that sometimes. And when I go back, hey, your property's increased in value, that could be the one good thing, but that gets overshadowed by all the bad stuff as well. So we need a bit of perspective to go, you're buying in an awesome country. We're buying a piece of land in this incredible country. There's going to be some roller coaster rides that come with it. We've got to strap ourselves in.
Mm, yeah. Yeah, awesome. I love the idea of the broker challenging you and holding you to account on what you're trying to do. Aaron, I've learned a tremendous amount, and I'm sure people will get a lot out of that. Thank you very much for joining me on Geared for Growth.
Thanks, Mike. Really appreciate it, mate. Keep up the work. I love the episodes that you've done. I get a lot out of it. I've shared it with clients, for example, where I'm not qualified to give that advice. And so I say, keep up the great work. It's really doing a service to the community as well.
Thank you. That's very kind of you, mate. And I won't stop even if you want me to. Thanks, Aaron. We'll chat to you again soon, hopefully.
Wonderful. Thanks, Mike.